Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Vanished ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
They were able to give me what they felt was a fairly accurate portrait of Emma. The portrait they drew for me was somebody in serious distress, emotional, mental distress. But that's what I started basing my search on, because they told me all kinds of things about Emma's behavior and how odd it was and how she had changed. She had gone from being one person. They said she literally within about 10 days became a completely different person.
...26-year-old Emma Filipov disappeared from Victoria, British Columbia on November 28, 2012. On the evening of Emma's disappearance, she was spotted by an acquaintance standing barefoot on a street corner. He described her as looking paranoid and disoriented. After speaking with Emma, he decided to contact the police. Police officers spoke to Emma for about 45 minutes that night before letting her walk away barefoot into the cold November night. That's the last confirmed sighting of Emma. As Emma's mom, Shelley, began looking for answers, she learned that others had observed signs that Emma's mental health had been deteriorating for some time leading up to her disappearance. Emma's case is one of those ones with a lot of bizarre clues that point in all different directions, but none of those clues have led to Emma. I'm Marissa, and this is episode 102 of The Vanished. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner. And it's great for my evening walks, too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. Emma grew up in Perth, Ontario, and was one of four children. Prior to Emma's move from Perth to Victoria, her parents had gone through a tough separation and divorce. Those close to Emma believe that this had a significant impact on her, but she was a deeply private person who didn't often confide in others about things she was struggling with. Emma is known as a very intelligent, creative, and talented woman. She traveled to China to teach English and got diplomas in photojournalism and culinary arts. Her friends have described her as free-spirited, adventurous, independent, and kind. She loved caring for the elderly, children, and pets. In the fall of 2011, Emma moved to Victoria, which is at the southern end of Vancouver Island. This seemed to be a good fit for her because of the abundance of outdoor activities that she loved so much. She would often spend time with local artists and street performers in the area. When she first moved to Victoria, she stayed with a friend for a while and eventually found a job as a barista at a local cafe. Several months after her move, her lifestyle changed a bit to what others have described as more transient. She stayed at a local hotel while cleaning rooms, and sometimes she stayed on friends' boats in the harbor and even reportedly slept in the woods. From February of 2012 up until the time of her disappearance, she began staying at a local women's shelter for periods of time on and off. Emma got a job at a local seafood restaurant in the Inner Harbor called Redfish Bluefish. This was a seasonal job, which ended at the end of October. Her employer expected Emma to return and work the following season, which would have begun in February of 2013. Unfortunately, before that could happen, Emma disappeared. As I mentioned, Emma was such a private person. She didn't have a cell phone or social media accounts. Mostly, she contacted her family via email, but they didn't really know what was going on and weren't aware that she had been living in a shelter. I spoke to Emma's mom, Shelley, for this episode, and she explained Emma's private nature to me.
Because she didn't believe in cell phones, we communicated primarily by emails. She would occasionally call. She'd either borrow somebody's phone or use a phone booth, reverse the charges. I didn't think much of it, to be perfectly honest, because that would be like Emma. Not having a cell phone was very much Emma. She never had a cell phone. When she was growing up and as she was a teenager and all her friends were getting cell phones, Emma did not want one. So her not having a phone didn't ring any bells for me. It didn't alert me to anything bizarre. So we communicated via email primarily, and her emails were always very light, very happy, often written poetically. No specifics. Not, you know, I've got a job doing such and such. This is my new address. I'm living with so and so. There was none of that kind of information. And we knew enough not to pose too many questions because Emma was very private. And if we started digging into her life, there was a chance that she might not get back in touch with us for a while because that would probably upset her. She didn't like us digging into her life.
It wasn't until Shelley received a tearful call from her daughter that she realized that something wasn't quite right.
Well, I didn't know anything in the months leading up to her disappearance. It wasn't until Friday, November 23rd, that she phoned me in tears asking to come home. So I said, well, absolutely. There's always, that's a given in our family. If you need to come home, you come home. And she cried and she got very upset. And I said, listen, I'll get on my laptop and I'll send you an e-ticket and it'll be there tomorrow morning. And you just go and you pick it up and you fly home and I'll meet you in Ottawa and in 12 hours you'll be home. And she cried some more. We talked a little bit, but very little. She was very incoherent. And then she said, I can't do it on my own. I need help. I can't do all that by myself. I have things to bring and I just can't do that on my own. Would you come and get me? So I said, of course. So what I'll do is when we get off the phone, I'll book a ticket for myself and I'll come to Victoria and I'll be there on Saturday. This is a Friday night. I said, I'll be there on the Saturday. So that's what our agreement was. So I booked a ticket. Sometime Saturday morning, I get a phone call from her, and she's still very distraught. But this time she says, I'm just having a bad time. I'd like to figure things out for myself. Please cancel your ticket. Please don't come. So I canceled my ticket, thinking, okay, so maybe she is having a bad day, and she just, you know, showed it a little more strenuously than she might otherwise have. So I respect that wish. And then on Sunday, I think it was, I got another call. And again, she's very distraught. She's very distressed. She's in tears. And I've changed my mind. I do need to come home and I do need help. And would you come? And I said, of course, same thing. Book a ticket. Said, I'll book a ticket. It'll take me where I live in terms of where the closest airport is an hour. So, and it's a 5.5 or 6 hour flight. So I said, will you give me 12 hours and I will be there? So she said, okay, fine. And then that was fine. At no point had we discussed address yet, like where she was. So after I spoke to her, I decided that I would call back the number that she had called from. And the name that came up on the phone was Sandy Merriman. So I just assumed that it was her roommate and that the phone was in her name. So when I called, they answered Sandy Merriman Woman Shelter. So that was the first time I discovered that she wasn't staying in an apartment, but that she was, in fact, staying at a woman's shelter. So then we had a couple of phone calls back and forth, and it was always the same, please come, don't come, please come, don't come. We had a few of those, and then on the Tuesday, I thought, well, she doesn't want me to come, but I can't keep doing this and wondering what's going on. So the last phone call I got was Wednesday morning, the day she went missing, on November 28th, early. It was about 7 o'clock here, so about 4 o'clock British Columbia time. And she said, don't come, not today, Mom. And she hung up. That's all she said.
Little did Shelley know that would be the last conversation that she'd have with Emma. Even though Emma told her not to come, Shelley made the trip to Victoria anyway.
So I got on a plane, I got organized, and I got on a plane. I couldn't get a plane till 5 o'clock. Got on the flight, got to Victoria by 9 o'clock that night, grabbed a cab. By the time I got my baggage and got a cab and everything, it was 11 o'clock when I arrived at the woman's shelter. And they let me in, and I told them who I was, and they said, well, Emma's not here. So I didn't panic at first, because I thought, oh, well, she must be staying with a friend, even though I think in the back of my mind I was panicking, but I was trying to, you know, maintain my composure. So I said, oh, okay, why isn't she here? And they said, well, we were expecting her. We had a bed for her. They have to claim their bed by a certain time. I don't remember the time. I think it might be, it's either 8 o'clock or 10 o'clock. Anyway, she hadn't shown up, and I was there at 11. So she had missed her chance of getting the bed. And she never did show up. By midnight, the supervisor felt that Emma should be considered a missing person. Now, keep in mind that Emma had not always, this is what I find very strange, is that Emma had not always claimed the bed that she was entitled to at the shelter. She did often go stay with friends for a couple of days. And yet on that particular night, they, with my appearance there, they decided to call the police and give her the status of missing persons. So I found that odd. The police arrived shortly after. So by about midnight, the police were there, and they agreed that she should be considered a missing person. I find that odd. I find that odd. That made me, that something clicked, and I thought, that's bizarre. It's not the first time she hasn't shown up, so what is different about tonight? Why is tonight so different? It was about 2 o'clock in the morning by the time we had finished with the police. And I said, I'm going to go across the street and get a hotel room. And then I'm going to walk the streets of Victoria and see if I can find her. The police officer was adamant that I shouldn't be walking on the streets, that the streets of Victoria were not safe. Well, I can tell you now, having walked the streets of Victoria, you know, till 1 o'clock in the morning, that they are perfectly safe. But anyhow, I listened to the police officer. I regret that. I wish I'd gone right out and started looking. I booked into a hotel, and I asked for a room at the front. As it happened, this hotel was directly across from the shelter. So I asked for a room at the front of the house, and at the front of the hotel. And from my bed, I could sit on the bed and watch the shelter. So I sat there till daylight watching to see if she did show up, which, of course, she didn't. So that's what led up to her being considered a missing person.
Since Emma had been living in a shelter, it was hard for Shelley to get information from the people who worked there. As you can imagine, due to privacy laws, they couldn't say too much, and also, shelters have rules to protect those who stay there, since many women who stay in shelters are running away from abusive situations. Shelley didn't give up and kept going back and asking questions. Each time she went, she got a little more information.
I'm not privy to all the information that the police have gathered. And because of the privacy laws, it's very difficult to get information. I chose to keep returning to the shelter and kind of picking their brains just a little bit at a time. Different staff members, the frontline staff changed, you know, whatever their shift was. So I would ask a couple of questions. And when I felt that I was pushing too much, then I'd back off. But then the next day I'd stop in again and talk to them, and they were able to give me what they felt was a fairly accurate portrait of Emma. And what the portrait they drew for me was somebody in serious distress, emotional, mental distress. I don't know that the police found this or not, as again, I wasn't privy to that information, but that's what I started basing my search on, because they told me all kinds of things about Emma's behavior and how odd it was and how she had changed. She had gone from being one person. They said she literally within about 10 days became a completely different person. She went from being one person. She went to being from this particular Emma, like they said, very, very sweet and very quiet, not forthcoming, not social, but very sweet and very kind and very approachable. If someone did approach her, she would be, you know, very nice about it. But she kept to herself. But within about a space of 10 days to 2 weeks, her behavior started to change. She became, they said she became unusual. She became somewhat strange, cooking at all hours of the night and really avoiding people and moving furniture out of the shelter out onto their lawn, saying that there was causing a noise and it was really bothering her. She could hear these items in her head. That went on for a while. I kept going back because that was my best source of information. So that's how I determined that it sounded like, I mean, I don't know for a fact at all, but it sounded like she had a psychotic break based on what they told me. That's where that came from. It's not because she'd been diagnosed or anyone knew for sure. It was based on all these little pieces put together. I found out from good friends from earlier on in her life that she had had mental issues and she had made them promise to never divulge them to her parents. And yet she always managed to pull herself out of whatever distress she was in. One of her best friends said she always phoenixed her way out of whatever situation she was in. But they've told me since her disappearance some, you know, relatively startling stories about emotional upset that Emma would have, which I was not aware of, and her dad was not aware of, and her siblings were not aware of. None of us were aware. Emma was very adept at keeping things hidden. Like, she was going through a lot of trauma for a number of years, and nobody was aware of it until she got a little bit older and she found it more difficult to hide it. And that's when her closest friends got to see a side of her that was obviously in distress.
After Emma's disappearance, Shelley was dealing with this mystery of what happened to her daughter, but also she had to unravel the mystery of what was going on in Emma's life. Who was she spending time with? Shelley was hoping that Emma's friends in Victoria may have some answers.
So I just started postering the city. I just started plastering the city with posters. I got permission from the police to get her laptop back from them because they had confiscated all her, or most of her belongings from her van. And I asked if I could please have the laptop back because I had met somebody who knew Emma. And that was the other thing. I didn't know anybody in Victoria, let alone any of her friends or acquaintances. So it wasn't like I could just call up so-and-so and say, what can you tell me about Emma? Because she had never talked to us about any new friends or anybody. Not an acquaintance, not a friend, nothing. So anyways, I finally did connect with this young man who Emma was good friends with, and he was able to get through the password and get into her laptop. And it was through her laptop that I was able to track down a few people. She either had emails from them, so it was the name and the email address, or there'd be a name and a phone number. So that way I was able to track down a handful of people that knew her. And also I ran into people that knew her just as I pounded the pavement with the missing poster. People would say, oh, Emma. Oh, I know Emma. I've known Emma forever. I think I've known Emma since she's been in Victoria. And I ask, have you seen her lately? No, no, no. Now that you mention it, I haven't seen her for a while. And that's what I kept getting. Those were the responses I kept getting. Two or three of those people were actually quite good friends. One of them she had dated. I asked him why they had broken up. And he was from Montreal originally, and he had wanted to return to Montreal to visit family and friends, and wanted Emma to go with him, and she didn't want to leave Victoria, so they broke up. But he couldn't tell me. He hadn't seen her again since. When he came back to Victoria, he hadn't seen Emma. He hadn't heard from her. There was nothing. There's absolutely nothing.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. Shelley has worked very hard to find any information that could possibly lead to Emma, or provide some insight into what was going on in the time leading up to her disappearance. She's been able to compile a very detailed timeline of what Emma was doing in the months, weeks, and days before she vanished. People had been noticing that Emma was exhibiting some odd behavior for a while, but no one had reached out to Shelley before Emma disappeared. In the winter of 2011, Emma's friend and roommate noticed that she started obsessively arranging objects. These objects ranged from feathers to rocks to food. After a particular incident when this friend awoke to find Emma outside in the middle of the night, apparently in a euphoric state, the friend was concerned enough to reach out to Emma's father, James. He offered to fly Emma home, but she refused. Since Emma was so private, she was upset to learn that her father had even been contacted. Emma's parents were divorced by this time, and Shelley wasn't notified about this incident. Three of Emma's friends have come forward stating that Emma had expressed to them that she was feeling harassed by someone. She said that she had met this person while attending culinary school several years prior in Campbell River, British Columbia. Unfortunately, she never went into detail about this or even mentioned a name. She also began to show concerns about social interactions with men. Because of this, she would not stay in co-ed shelters. In the summer of 2012, her friends in Victoria began to see some changes in her. She decided to cut out alcohol, cigarettes, coffee, and sugar, which all sound like positive changes, but then she started eating less and less food, but would drink large amounts of water. At this point, she began to get very thin. Her friends began noticing some personality changes as well. They had once known her to be quite sociable, but now she seemed fearful, paranoid, and withdrawn. On one hand, she was telling friends about big travel plans like sailing to Mexico, moving to California, or possibly Costa Rica. She had even mentioned going back to Perth to surprise her family. On the other hand, she canceled travel plans with friends and seemed fearful to go anywhere besides the pier or the women's shelter. During the summer before her disappearance, she had purchased a van that she intended to live out of and travel in. This didn't end up working out for Emma, and the van just added to the stress that she was under. It had to be towed a few times before she went missing, and she had been trying to find an inexpensive mechanic. A couple weeks before Emma's disappearance, one of her friends drove past the shelter and saw her standing outside, appearing to be cold and wet. Emma was just standing there staring blankly at birds nearby. This is when the staff at the shelter became concerned about Emma, too.
They observed her acting paranoid. As Shelley had mentioned earlier, Emma was moving furniture outside because it was making noise and talking to her. They also noticed that she would keep the curtains closed all the time, and she was getting rid of some of her belongings. The shelter staff became so concerned that they called the local police to see if they could do a mental health check on Emma. The police didn't come out, but requested that the staff call back if she continued with this odd behavior. The staff members couldn't contact Emma's family because that would have violated privacy laws. Unfortunately, they never contacted the police department again to request that they come check on Emma. One of Emma's friends encouraged her to go to a local YMCA to get a membership. That way, she could spend less time at the shelter. Several days before Emma disappeared, she did go to the YMCA to get a membership. Investigators were able to obtain the surveillance footage from the YMCA. The footage shows Emma behaving in a very paranoid manner. She went in and out of the building 4 times in just 14 minutes, each time stopping to look out the window beforehand as if she were looking for someone. The following day, she called a tow truck driver to tow her Mazda van from a town a little under an hour away. The driver said that Emma appeared to be upbeat and spoke to him about moving back to Perth. Only 2 days later, she began making the phone calls that Shelley had described earlier. In the first call, she told Shelley that she wanted to come home, and Shelley promised to book a flight for Emma to return to Perth. The following day, Emma called Shelley twice. In the first call, she told Shelley that she had changed her mind and wanted to stay and figure things out on her own. Later, she called a second time and said that she did want to come home after all, but that she needed Shelley to travel to Victoria to help her move back. Shelley agreed to book a flight right away. The next day, Emma called and had again changed her mind. Shelley agreed not to fly out to Victoria. That same day, Emma had to have her van towed yet again. This time, she had it towed to the parking lot of a local hotel. The day before Emma disappeared, Shelley decided to call the number that Emma had been calling from. Remember, Shelley didn't know that Emma had been staying in a shelter, and since the name Sandy Merriman was showing up on her caller ID, she thought that this was the name of a friend that Emma was staying with. She didn't know that it was the name of a shelter until she called that number. A staff member informed Shelley that Emma had been staying at the shelter on and off for many months. That same day, a notice was put on Emma's van by the hotel staff saying that she needed to move it or it would be towed. That night, Emma once again called Shelley asking to come home. Shelley then booked a flight to Victoria for the next day, which is the day that Emma disappeared. At 4:30 a.m. on the 28th, Emma made her last phone call to her mom. This is when she again told her mom not to come, but this time Shelley didn't listen and took the first flight she could catch. At 7 a.m., Emma went to the hotel where her van was parked. This is when she saw the notice that had been placed on her van the day before. She got very upset and asked a staff member for one more day, and they said that was okay. At 8:23 a.m., Emma went to a 7-Eleven and used her debit card to buy a $200 Visa prepaid card. There's surveillance footage of this trip to 7-Eleven, and just like the video from the YMCA, Emma appeared to be looking out the door as if she were looking for someone or maybe thought someone was following her. Sometime around 10 a.m., a man that Emma knew claims to have seen her while he was riding a bus. He saw her standing on the street, so he got off the bus to go speak to her. He asked her if she needed help, and she just shook her head no. This man's name is Julian, and remember him because he becomes more important later on. He's given conflicting accounts of this sighting in the past, sometimes saying it was the day before she went missing, and sometimes saying it was the day of her disappearance. In the afternoon, a friend of Emma's spotted her near a local soup kitchen. She told him that she wasn't feeling well and couldn't talk. It's been reported that Emma may have been in the library that day, and she was known to frequently visit the library. Another witness claims to have seen her walking along the street around 1 p.m. looking vacant-eyed. Two other witnesses saw Emma that afternoon and were so concerned by her behavior that they called 911. We don't know if the police responded to this call. Another witness from that afternoon said they saw her walking with an old man, and another person believed that they saw her at a different shelter called Rock Bay. One important thing to note is that this is a co-ed shelter, and if you remember earlier, I mentioned that Emma refused to stay in co-ed shelters. Yet another witness reported seeing her on 2 different occasions between 4 and 6 p.m. They first saw her as they exited a shopping mall, and then again about 45 minutes later when she crossed in front of their car while they were driving. At 5:54 p.m., Emma went back to the 7-Eleven where she had purchased the prepaid credit card at 8:23 a.m. This time, she purchased a prepaid cell phone. Again, she stood by the doors looking out as if she were looking for someone or afraid of something. The cell phone that she purchased has never been activated. Around 6 p.m., she went back to the women's shelter. A staff member informed Emma that her mom was coming, and Emma became very upset and left. Another resident tried to catch up to Emma, but she never did. There's one strange thing about this interaction that Emma had at the shelter. We don't know how the shelter staff knew that Shelley was on her way. Shelley had spoken to them on the phone on the 27th, but she didn't mention that she was traveling to Victoria. It's just one of the many mysteries of this case. About 10 minutes after she left the shelter, she got into a taxi and asked the driver to take her to the airport. She asked the driver how much the fare would be, and he said about $60. She told the driver that she couldn't afford the fare, but Emma had that $200 prepaid card on her and also her debit card, which gave her access to the money in her bank account that contained between $2,000 and $3,000. Instead of going to the airport, she asked the driver to drop her off where he had picked her up, and when they stopped, she asked if she could sit in his taxi for a while. The driver reported that Emma was acting strangely while in his vehicle. She was startled by the dispatch radio and asked why there was noise coming out of it. When she got out of the taxi, she paid the fare with her debit card. Just 5 minutes later, Dennis Quay, who's been described as an acquaintance of Emma's, happened to see her standing barefoot on the street corner. Just like the other witnesses, he described her as looking disoriented and paranoid. He said that she kept looking around, so he asked her if she was looking for something or if someone was following her. She asked Dennis to walk with her, but she didn't like his questions, so she continued along on her own. He was so concerned about Emma that he called 911 at 7 p.m. The police located Emma at 7:17 p.m. She was walking along the street, still barefoot. While she was speaking with them, she would only shake her head yes or no, and sometimes provided one-word answers. They spoke with Emma for 45 minutes before deciding to let her go because she didn't appear to be a danger to herself or anyone else. This is the last confirmed sighting of Emma Filipov. Just a couple hours later, Shelley made it to the shelter that Emma had been staying at and found that Emma wasn't there. This is when the police were notified and a missing persons report was filed. The following day, Emma's van was located by the police, and they found that she had left her passport, journals, laptop, and camera. On December 2nd, a woman came forward claiming to have seen her in the Inner Harbor area, and that Emma had told her to remember the name Emma Filipov, and asked the woman to repeat her name 3 times. Shelley gave me her take on this sighting.
That is the only one that I think there could be truth to, because how, it's just such an odd thing. It's just such an odd thing, and then it fits with what I learned about my daughter. And she says that this happened before she knew Emma was missing. This woman swears that occurred before she knew that Emma was missing. If that's in fact true, then it must have been Emma, because where would she come up with the name Emma Filipov, if that is in fact true? She was quite upset that I wasn't 100% convinced the woman was. But again, how do I know if I don't see a picture of my own daughter? How am I going to know?
3 days after that sighting in the harbor, there was an important break in the case. Remember that prepaid debit card that Emma had purchased on the morning of her disappearance? Well, it was used at a gas station. The police had flagged the card after Emma was reported missing, so they were notified when it was used. The police claimed that this card was found on the side of the road near Juan de Fuga Recreation Center and Galloping Goose Trail. Now, if you look up those areas on a map, it would have taken Emma a few hours to walk that far from where she was last seen, but no one reported seeing her walking in that direction. There were so many sightings of her the night that she went missing, but not one of them places her there or even going in that direction. It's very strange. It gets even more strange, though, because the man who found the card has called Shelley on multiple occasions and now claims that he doesn't remember where he found the card.
Well, that's a mystery in itself. So a gentleman found it and used it to buy a carton of cigarettes. And as soon as, because the card was flagged, so as soon as it was used, it flagged for the police. So they went to the gas station, little convenience store. They discovered who it was. And this man was a recovering alcoholic. The police told me that the card, that he said that the card had been found in such and such a place. However, that same man called me many, many months, I'm thinking more over a year later, to say, that's not where I found the card. As a matter of fact, I was drinking and I don't know where I found the card. And he called me three different times. How he got my phone number, I don't know. I guess he knew I was from Ontario. I mean, Filipov is not a common name. He claims that he has no recollection of where he found the card, which is very bizarre because the police claim that they know exactly where the card was found. It is very strange to me as well. Very strange to me as well. I just don't understand it. And for him to phone me, what would be the purpose of him phoning me? Why is he phoning me? And he phoned first and he said, I'm really, really nervous. I'm really nervous about calling you. I'm calling you about the card. I can't really talk about it right now. I just wanted to call and introduce myself. My name is Mike. He said, but that's all I can really do right now because I'm nervous. So I'm going to call you back. And then he did call me back a second time. And it was more of the same, only he was a little more at ease. And it wasn't until the third phone call that he told me that he didn't know how the police could say where the card was found because he himself couldn't remember where the card was found. So how the police figured that out, we don't know. I find it a very bizarre thing. Very bizarre. It is. It's extremely bizarre.
The man who found Emma's prepaid card was questioned and polygraphed by the police, and they have apparently cleared him as a suspect. That brings us to Julian, who was mentioned earlier in the timeline. He's the one who had reported seeing Emma on the day of her disappearance while he was riding a bus. He got out and asked her if she needed help, and she shook her head no. Well, Julian had met Emma back in 2011, when she was still living in Perth. They met at a music festival after Emma caught his eye. They hung out on several occasions, and according to Julian, things got romantic when he kissed her one night. But after that, Emma was no longer interested. They did see each other a couple more times until Emma became offended when Julian made a comment about her pants. It appears that Julian may have had a crush on Emma and that she wasn't really interested in him in the same way that he was interested in her. He too moved to Victoria and claims that this wasn't to pursue Emma. He helped search for Emma, and then some messages were discovered that he had sent to Emma's parents months before her disappearance. There was also a message that he sent to Emma after her disappearance, offering to build her a cabin in the woods. At that point, he became a person of interest in the case. Shelley told me more about her strange interactions with Julian.
Julian was part of the search team when I first went out there. I didn't find him. There weren't any emails to or from Julian on her laptop. He actually came and found me, which stood out as bizarre. It stood out as odd to me. And one of the things I did in the hopes of finding Emma was I would go to the Victoria Public Library, and I would install myself at a computer in the computer section, which happened to face the front door. Emma was known to be in the library daily. She was known to use the computers quite often. She was also using the books, but she was also using the computer. That's where she was emailing from. I decided that I would sit in the computer area, but I would watch the front door. So one day, fairly early on, I noticed that there's this young man standing at the research computer station. And he's looking at me, and I'm thinking, this is really odd, because I didn't know Julian. Even though he lived close to my hometown, You know, he had lived in Perth and knew Emma, and my ex-husband knew him. I did not know him. I did not know him. The year that they met, I believe, is the summer I was in Africa, so I never got to meet him. Anyhow, I get up from the computer and I go over and I said, do I know you? Can I help you? And then he went on to explain who he was and that he recognized me from Facebook. Well, that struck me as odd, because how do you recognize somebody in a crowd? He's never met you, right? You know, he's never met me. I don't know how he picked me out, but it was definitely me he was staring at. And when I went over, he said, yeah. He said, you're Emma's mom, aren't you? And I said, yes. How do you know? He said, well, it's from looking at pictures of you on Facebook. So that was really weird. So then he joined forces with what I refer to as the search team. There were a few of us. And he helped poster and he helped do a lot of things like that. At a certain point, I started getting not a bad vibe, just not a great vibe. I think I just really saw Julian as a bit of a social misfit. My gut doesn't tell me that he is responsible for Emma's disappearance. But by the same token, my gut doesn't tell me that he's perfectly okay. You know, he lived in Perth, and he was going to school in Perth, and that's where he met Emma. And that's very near our hometown. It was Emma's hometown at the time because she was staying with her dad. This is where they met. Emma makes plans to go back out west. She wasn't sure where she wanted to go. Emma was a very free-spirited young woman. And she said, I'm just going to arbitrarily pick a place in the west. She liked the west. She had been there. She had gone to North Island College to become a chef. She worked at the Royal Coachman Pub as a chef in Campbell River. So she knew that she loved being out west. So she came home for a little while because she quit her job because she has a congenital knee problem. So she left her job, came home in, I guess that would have been in 2011, saw the surgeon, nothing could be done, blah, 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 meets Julian here in Perth. So in the fall of 2011, Emma decides that she's going back out west and she has chosen Victoria. She has not told Julian that she's chosen Victoria. She has just made that decision. Lo and behold, Julian shows up in Victoria a few months later. That strikes me as too much of a coincidence. I'm not a big believer in coincidences to begin with. This to me struck me as a huge coincidence. I said, oh, come on, Julian, you had to know that she was coming to Victoria. And he said, no, I didn't know. And she had bought it. She ended up flying because we wouldn't let her take a bus, but she had bought a bus ticket. And she kept it in her back pocket of her jeans. And I think he saw it or something. Because I just can't believe that he decided on Victoria based on the fact that he could paddle. He was a paddler. That he could paddle year-round. That he had the water and the mountains. But I find it, I find it. And that threw kind of a wrench in his being considered innocent. Because I don't think anybody believes that he accidentally fell across Emma and Victoria. I mean, I think that's the general consensus among the public, is that there's no way that he accidentally showed up in Victoria. It's very odd. It really is.
Julian was questioned and polygraphed. The police have stated that he's no longer considered a person of interest in the case.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match, and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished.
Then there was another strange man who popped up in 2014. Many refer to him as the Green Shirt Man. This incident happened in a shop located in downtown Vancouver. The man tore down one of Emma's missing persons posters and commented that Emma wasn't missing. She was his girlfriend and wanted to be left alone. The shop owner thought the man was creepy and immediately called the police. Despite the fact that they were able to get decent images of this man on surveillance video that showed his many tattoos and a noticeable limp, no one has ever come forward to identify him. Shelley gave me her thoughts on the Green Shirt Man.
We have had no tips, nobody getting in touch with the police, getting in touch with me, getting in touch with anybody to say, oh, I think I might know who he is. We've had people get in touch with X number of tattoo parlors, hoping that they would recognize the tattoos on the guy's arms. The surveillance footage is quite good, but to pick out the tattoos on his arms, much more difficult. But they look like flames. We decided that they were definitely flames. And actually, I just had an email from somebody who said I just emailed 36 different tattoo parlors in that area, hoping that they might recognize him. If not the tattoos, maybe recognize the man's face. But no, nobody came forward, and unfortunately, the Vancouver police, to whom the case does not belong, didn't go to the boutique until the next day. I think he arrived with a poster that he was crunching up, and he said to the wife who was at the cash, and he said, Emma's not missing, she just hates her fucking family and doesn't want to have anything to do with them. They kind of tossed the poster on their counter. If we could track him down, I think we might actually get some answers. That's my gut feeling there. But we don't know what else to do. We don't know what else to do to track him down. And depending who his associates are, nobody's going to give him up. If he's a drug dealer, if he's a pimp, nobody's going to give him up, right? People that are his enemies aren't going to give him up for fear of retaliation. And his friends sure aren't going to give him up. How are we going to find out who he is? So that has posed a dilemma and a very aggravating situation. He could very definitely be her boyfriend, her friend, her pimp, or her drug dealer if she's on drugs like him. But we don't know. We don't know what state Emma's in. I mean, nobody has heard a single thing from Emma for 5 years. It'll be 5 years on the 28th. Nobody has heard a single thing. So if she's on the street and she has had a psychotic break, my best guess is that she would turn to self-medication. And if she turns to self-medication, then how does she support that habit? You know what I mean? Like, so when people say, what do you think happened? Do you think she could be doing this? Or do you think she could be doing that? Do you think she's on drugs? And I say, well, she wasn't. We couldn't get anybody to tell us. The people that we talked to early on in Victoria, I couldn't find anybody to tell me that they had ever seen her smoke as much as a cigarette. But We don't know what happened after what I believe was a mental breakdown. Who knows? And people that are mentally unwell, who aren't medicated, who aren't treated, will quite naturally, quite normally turn to self-medicating. I mean, that's a known fact. That's not something I've made up. That's a known fact. So is that what's happened to her? I don't know. People ask me, what is your gut feeling? I don't have a gut feeling. I don't have a gut feeling. In the very early days, I had a gut feeling. I thought I'd just go around the corner and I would find her. I really did. I thought she's gone and stayed with a friend for a couple of days and she's going to show back up at the shelter or I'm going to see her on the street. And for the first two days, for sure, possibly 3 days, I really believed that. But now I don't have a gut feeling. I don't know. I mean, for all I know, she's been kidnapped and somebody's holding her. And people say, oh, well, that's just in movies and stuff. No, I'm sorry. That doesn't happen just in movies. That happens on a daily basis across North America.
People have reported many different sightings of Emma over the years, but none of them have ever been confirmed. There have been some pictures that have surfaced that people thought were Emma, but they ended up being other women who just looked like her. Often these sightings come in long after the fact, which makes it next to impossible to track them down.
We've had some people call in or send in tips to the police or email me saying, we think we may have seen Emma. Unfortunately, a sighting is only as good as its substantiation. And if it can't be substantiated, it's not really much good to us. We've asked people to do their very best, not that it would be easy, but to do their very best to take a picture of the person they think is Emma. None of them have proven to be her at all. And the police follow up tell me that they follow up all tips that they get. Now, and every now and then also what will happen, Marissa, is that what they'll do is they will get in touch with me and say, felt that I should reach out to you and let you know that last summer we were camping in such and such an area and there was a young woman there that really reminded us of Emma. Well, telling me that last summer they saw somebody is not very useful to me. These people mean well. You know, they've taken the time to mull it over all this time, and then they decide, oh, I think I better let her know that what we saw, what we think we saw. But, you know, even a day later is probably too late, let alone months. I've had a few emails like that. You know, wish we had stopped, wish we had talked to her, wish we had this, wish we had that. And some of them were as long as a year prior. That's been very, very difficult.
One thing that I noticed while speaking to Shelley is that she's very realistic about all the possible outcomes in this case. She's skeptical of sightings, which I think is a healthy way to look at them. It's very hard to get your hopes up with each sighting only to be let down when they don't pan out. One theory that some have suggested to Shelley is that Emma could be in a commune somewhere, but she doesn't put much stock into that theory.
People that try to boost my morale, they say, well, try to think of her in a really nice commune somewhere, you know, communing with nature. And I think to myself, that's not where Emma is. Come on, think about it. 5 years, no contact with her family. If she's in a commune, she's not well, and she doesn't know who she is, because there's no way that she would not get in touch. There's just no way. There's just no way.
We know from all the witnesses who saw Emma in the days leading up to her disappearance that something was seriously wrong. Shelley fears that this vulnerable state could have made Emma an easy target.
She was so vulnerable that night. So somebody offered her a ride, the wrong person. I mean, somebody could be holding her. And I don't think that I'm being melodramatic when I say that. I don't think I'm being melodramatic when I give any option. I think I'm being realistic that these are the choices we have.
It's a possibility that Emma could be out there living among the homeless, or maybe she just started over somewhere else. If you believe the green shirt man, maybe that's true. If she's out there, Shelley just wants to know that she's okay, and even an email would be enough.
Even if it was just an email, I'm fine, leave me alone. Or I'm not fine, leave me alone. I don't want to be in touch with anybody. Anything. But there's been nothing. Absolutely nothing. But I really, really can honestly say I have no idea what's happened to my daughter.
I think that before we can really look at the different theories in Emma's case, we have to look at Emma's mental state. Now, I'm not a mental health expert, but I don't think that you need to be one in order to realize that something was very wrong. It's clear that Emma was struggling for some time, and in those final weeks and days, it had become a critical situation. Everyone who knew Emma knew how private she was, and it appears that they were afraid to overstep her boundaries, so no one really pushed too hard when they noticed things that weren't quite right. In hindsight, we can look back and see how unfortunate it is that the police didn't respond when the shelter staff asked for help before she disappeared. And I also understand Shelley's frustrations about the night that Emma went missing, when the police let her walk away barefoot into the cold night. We've seen this before in other cases that I've covered where the police let someone go and then they disappeared. Deanne Hastings and Jonathan Hamilton both come to mind. Law enforcement will tell you that there's only so much they can do in these situations. Sometimes their hands are tied. Shelley's tried to get more information about Emma's interactions with the two police officers that night, but they've never released the details of her conversation. And the identities of the officers are protected by privacy laws. She tried submitting a Freedom of Information request, but that was denied. I think the one detail about Emma eating less and less food and instead drinking copious amounts of water may be important. We all think that drinking more water is healthy, and for most of us, it probably is, but there's a point where it can become too much. I looked up the side effects of drinking too much water and found that some of the side effects include headache, personality changes, changes in behavior, confusion, irritability, and drowsiness. I also found that drinking excessive amounts of water can be associated with schizophrenia, because schizophrenia can cause excessive thirst. I wonder if she was at the point where she was consuming too much water, if this could have been contributing to some of the behavior she was exhibiting, or if possibly it was a side effect of a mental illness. Some people think that Emma was being stalked or followed based on the surveillance videos of her looking out the doors of the 7-Eleven and the YMCA. But was she being followed, or was she suffering from paranoia? One thing that strikes me about Emma's behavior was that it was strange enough for two different people to call 911 on the day that she went missing. Also, many people noticed her that day. That's why I wanted to go through all those different sightings of her before her disappearance. She was standing out to people. What bothers me is that people kept noticing her all day long, but then once the police let her go, that all stopped. Where did she go? No one else claims to have seen her walking anywhere that night. If we go by the place that the police say her card was found, she would have had to have walked for a very long time to get there. But then you have to remember that the man who found the card now claims that he doesn't remember where he found it. That within itself is suspicious. The main theories in Emma's case fit into a few different categories, including suicide, foul play, she left on her own, she wandered off and is either out there and possibly doesn't know who she is, or she wandered off and succumbed to the elements. With the suicide theory, the water is often mentioned. Divers were sent into the harbor to search for Emma, but they never found anything. There's a show called The Fifth Estate that did an episode about Emma's disappearance. You can find it on YouTube if you'd like to watch it. They had an expert on who mentioned that if she had gone into the water during that time of year, he wouldn't have expected her body to go very far. He said that he would have expected her to be close to the harbor or the shoreline within less than 5 kilometers at most. The theory of her wandering off and passing away in the wilderness somewhere is kind of similar, in that you would expect that she would have been found, or maybe that some of her belongings would have been found. Searches of the trails, parks, and even some of the smaller islands were conducted, and nothing was ever found except for that prepaid card. Could Emma have wandered off and she's out there possibly among the homeless? I think that anything's possible. Plus, it's been 5 years now, and if she's living on the streets, her appearance may have changed. I struggle with the idea of Emma leaving intentionally. From all the witness testimony about her behavior, I think that it would have been hard for her to plan her own disappearance. Why would she have alerted her mom that something was wrong if she planned on disappearing? I also wonder about the things she left behind, especially her journals. She was so private, I doubt that she would have wanted anyone reading all of those thoughts that she kept to herself for so many years. Also, would someone who is so private want this kind of attention, having her life story told so publicly. If she wanted to pick up and move somewhere, she could have done just that and continued to keep in contact with her family via email. It seems like her close friends and family members respected her boundaries and need for privacy. With the foul play theory, you have to look at it from multiple angles. Could she have met with a random predator that saw her as an easy victim due to her mental state? What about this man who found her prepaid credit card? It's very strange to me that he felt the need to call Shelley on multiple occasions. That's just not something that we see very often. Does he have a guilty conscience about something? Why did he keep saying he was nervous? What's he nervous about? That's someone that I wish maybe they had looked into a bit further. They said that he was cleared after questioning in a polygraph, but I don't really put much stock into polygraphs myself, since we know they're unreliable. Then there's Julian. Now, I do acknowledge that some of his behavior has been odd, and I understand why some people find his actions to be suspicious. Whether you want to believe that he moved to Victoria to pursue Emma or not, I don't necessarily think that makes him a murderer. Jordan from the Nighttime podcast interviewed Julian, and I listened to his interview. To me, he came across as a slightly awkward guy who had a crush on Emma and may have even been infatuated with her. But there's no evidence that he ever wished to harm Emma. There were times in his interview that he had a tendency to kind of over-explain himself, but I don't know if this is just a side effect of having people suspect that he could be involved in her disappearance, or maybe it's just part of his personality. But nothing he said really stood out to me to make me feel strongly that he was involved. One thing that I want to mention is that he didn't even have a vehicle at the time. Now, you don't need a vehicle to harm someone, but I do think it would make it harder to abduct a person off the street and dispose of them somehow without a vehicle. There's also the green shirt guy. It's strange to me that no one has ever come forward to identify him, and what he said was certainly strange too. Could he really have been Emma's boyfriend, or was he just a rambling person off the street? I've noticed since I started the show that missing persons cases often attract people with great intentions that want to help, but also some others with bad intentions who insert themselves in some way and can hurt the case. So could this man know something? Sure. But I think it's equally possible that he knows nothing. What about the person that she had mentioned feeling harassed by? The one that she said she met back when she was in culinary school. Was she really being harassed, or was this part of the paranoia that she was experiencing? What happened to Emma Filipov on November 28, 2012? Her case has so many mysteries within the larger mystery of her disappearance. After looking at all of these possible scenarios, I find it really hard to pick one theory to favor. I do wonder why Emma purchased that debit card and also the phone. We know that Emma didn't believe in cell phones. One struggle that I have is that I keep trying to make sense out of the things that Emma was doing, like buying those items. But we know that she was obviously struggling mentally, so can we really come to a rational conclusion for why she did one thing or another when she wasn't behaving rationally? Going back to the people who insert themselves into cases with negative intentions, Shelley and I also spoke about some scammers that she's run into on her journey to find Emma. This is something that I'm hearing more and more from families of the missing, and I like to put this information out there so others don't fall victim to these kinds of scammers. It's terrible, but people see desperate family members as easy victims who will go to great lengths to find answers.
I've had a couple of creepy people. When I was in Victoria, I had somebody who claimed they knew where she was, and they wanted me to meet at such and such an address, and I let the police know. We drove around the house, didn't see anything. We didn't go to the door. Then they changed the location. Anyways, they were just not above board, obviously. And they said, well, if we get half the reward money, because I offer $25,000 reward for any tip that leads us to Emma. Information that leads us to her, but we have to have Emma in person, in the flesh. None of this, you know. So they said, well, if you could give us half the reward money, then we would show, it would take you to her and you could give us the rest. And so I talked to the police and of course we said no. And then, was it last year or the year before, I had somebody get a hold of me and say that Emma was in, was it Michigan? Somewhere in the States. and that she worked in a strip club, and that they knew her, and that she had talked about us, and for $40,000, they would lead us to her. So I said, well, I need to know that it's Emma. So either you get a picture to me, or you ask her the following question: what nickname did she have for her younger brother? Because nobody knows it. So I said, you come up with either one of those, and then we can talk. But I was so distraught and so hopeful that it could be her that I at the time I had the private investigator working for me. So I had him hire two police officers from the town do surveillance for two full nights at this club, hoping that they would be able to spot Emma coming or going. So in that cost, it didn't cost me $40,000, but it cost me a fortune. And needless to say, it wasn't Emma. It turned out that the emails were coming from maybe as far as Australia. Yeah, they were scammers. And so it cost me $1,000 or $1,200. I don't know, more money than I had to spend on a scammer. What do you do when you're as distraught as I am as her mom? You'll do anything, you know? Well, my private investigator said, he said, please tell me you haven't sent them any money. And I said, well, of course not. Of course not. I haven't sent them a cent. He said, well, you know, parents get in such a state where they really want to believe that it's true. And I said, well, I really do want to believe, and that's why I want you to put these police officers on surveillance, but I'm not sending them $40,000. Finally, when the police got in touch with the private detective and they all got together, they were able to discover, and they said that it wasn't the first time that they had tried to scam somebody.
If you have any information regarding the disappearance of Emma Filipov, you can contact Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-TIPS or 1-800-222-8477. Or you can contact the Victoria Police Department at 250-995-7654. There's also an email address set up, and that's filipov@bell.net. If you would like to follow this case on Facebook, there's a group called Help Find Emma Filipov. That brings us to the end of episode 102. I'd like to thank Shelley for taking the time to speak with me. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. You can find me on Facebook, where there's both a page and a private discussion group. I'm on Twitter @TheVanishedPod and on Instagram as The Vanished Podcast. Join me next week. I'll be covering a case from Baltimore. Thanks for listening.
I'm hoping to target the U.S. Market because I can't say that she didn't make it to the States. I absolutely can. It would have been quite simple for her to make it to the U.S. So that's why this is important to me, that it be publicized in the States. Even in Canada, I mean, she could be anywhere, and I just am at a loss as to how to track her down, other than making her story very public and having her face made very public, and hopefully somebody will spot her.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide, when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.